If they are, you're going to ask them if they are operating as FBOs. And you're going to ask the if they're not either of those two things, you're going to review the leases with the Attorney General's office and the applications and the approvals and see what the language is requiring them to actually operate as FBOs since they got a preferred direct lease on that basis. And then you're going to look at the third one. You're going to check the lease for that also to see what the language is and ask them if they're actually operating as an FBO and report back on those three. Do I have that right?
Okay.
Mr. Ewan, did I miss anything?
Yes.
Tommy, did I miss
anything? Well, there was also mentioned that the lease that they have under review, that they'll look at the language of the lease with the Attorney General, because I think that we... Yes,
the current one that we just passed, which I think is somebody said was airborne.
Right, and that the language does not have this weakness that we've been discussing here, because I think we're all agreed that you come in as, you get a direct lease to be an FBO, you, on that basis that you operate as an FBO.
Okay, all right, is that clear enough direction for you folks?
Yeah, Mike, I think Ethan? That's fair for us. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. We really appreciate you looking into this and following up with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair and board members. Thank you.
All right. Aloha. All right, we're going to move to the D items. B1 will be next. We'll do a little change out here.
Good morning, board members. Russell Kuji for Land Division. On the first item, the consent to amend the consent to this amended sublease, when staff drafted this submittal, which is what it's trying to do, is come back to the board based upon the understanding that the sublease rents of $200,000. Would be continued throughout the term of the sublease, which now they're being asked, the board is being asked to consent to the extended term of the sublease to match the ground lease. And I think we gave an extension until 58 on the last board meeting. So that's what this, the genesis of this submittal started out as. And my staff on the Big Island, the board had also previously determined that $11,328 would be the participation in the $200,000 sublease rents for the lease at the time that it was up until 2028. And now Gordon prepared a submittal to, if we go beyond 2028, what would be our participation? And he calculates a little lower than $11,000 on the assumption that our ground lease will be going up based upon the agreement with the lessee and what was approved by the board. When we agendized this matter, I asked to see the sublease document, the amendment, and I found out that the rent of $300,000 is only set right now through 2038. And then it'll end to 2038 to 2048 and 2048 to 2058. The sublessee and sublessor will negotiate the rent, and it cannot go lower, but it can only go up. And so I'd like to make an amendment on this submittal on 1C to state that for the period starting 2038 and 2048, that the amount of the additional rent or sublease rent participation will be as shown on the submittal or as adjusted as may be appropriate at that time. We won't know it until 2048, 2058. I believe the tenants are available to comment on that. I don't know if the board has any questions.
Okay, questions. Board members, do you have any questions? All right, Mr. Kim, you're here for the applicant. Did you want to add anything?
Yes, good morning, Chair.
Ronald Kim here,
yeah. Thank you.
Appearing on behalf of JH Mokuhola LLC. And I am, you know, appearing here on item D1. And, you know, initially I just wanted to thank everyone on the board for their service. I know, you know, you're volunteers and, you know, we do appreciate, you know, all of your efforts here. I'm just picking up this matter following after Judge Peter Kubota now, because as you know, he did go up to the bench. So now I'm helping to represent J.H. Mokuhola. You know, we did get alerted to the fact, you know, that the department had concerns that the sublease could increase for the period beyond 2038. And we were gonna propose something similar to what Mr. Tsuji proposed. You know, and we are agreeable to that, that we agreed to keep the amounts, you know, as stated in the submittal, but that they can be adjusted as appropriate if the sublease rent does increase.
Okay, other questions, board members? Or any questions, board members?
I didn't quite catch what the fixed portion of the sublease was. Was it till 2038 or till 2048?
2038.
Okay. So the last, and Russell, this would go back to the board in 2038 then if it was adjusted?
If it needed to be adjusted, yes. Otherwise, it'll be this amount because the way the sublease rent sublease amendment is written, it'll be at minimum the $300,000 or possibly higher. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thanks for catching it. You know, that's important that we caught this and it can be readjusted because that was a awfully long time for a fixed term of a commercial lease, you know. Yes. Okay.
Okay, any other questions? If not, does somebody want to make a motion to approve this submittal as amended?
I move to approve as amended.
Second.
All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye, that is unanimous. Thank you very much. All right, thank you, Mr. Kim.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Board.
And I think, Gordon, are you still here for? Are you done?
Oh, no, I'm leaving. Yeah.
Yeah, you're good. All right. Thank you for joining. All right. Next up is D2. Let's see. We have nobody, no written testimony and no one presenting on this, so, well, from the applicant. So, Russell, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, this item is just a requesting a board to grant a perpetual non-exclusive utility easement to Hawaiian Electric and an immediate management right of entry.
Okay, any questions, board members? No questions? Is there a motion to approve as submitted?
So move.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
That's unanimous. Thank you. All right, D3, we have somebody joining for that.
Yes.
Hang on.
Your motion to approve is submitted.
Thank you for joining. You're going to have to turn off your YouTube while you're in the meeting if you have it on.
Yes.
Otherwise, we get a delay and an echo.
How does that sound? Okay,
thank you. That's good. Okay, Russell, you want to go ahead with D3?
Okay. D3 involves one of our leases up at Mauna Laha Valley. And it's asking the board to amend a prior board approval about an assignment. And the bottom line is this, they have submitted a small estates document indicating the appointment of Lane Ka'ai as the personal representative of the estate of Thomas Ka'ai. And so we're asking the board to approve the amendment to allow Lane Ka'ai as PR of the estate of Thomas Ka'ai to assign the leases for this Manoha property to specifically to Guy Ka'ai, Dale Ka'ai, Lane Ka'ai, and Noel Dane Ka'ai as joint tenants. And I believe Native Hawaiian Legal Counsel is present, who assisted with this matter on behalf of the tenants.
Okay, thank you. I see Ms. Kotaki is here. Do you want to add anything?
Good morning, Chair Case and members of the board. My name is Li'ula Kotaki, and I'm here representing Mr. Lane Ka'ai as the personal representative for the estate of Thomas H. Ka'ai Sr. So that's his father. Mr. Ka'ai is just seeking the board's approval to complete an assignment of his parents' Mauna Loa lease that had actually been approved back in May 2017. Unfortunately, both of his parents passed away before the final lease could be executed. And just recently in May, Mr. Ka'ai was appointed as the personal representative and is now able to complete this assignment. And so we're just seeking approval from the board today. All four of Mr. Ka'ai's brothers have signed letters in support of this lease assignment.
Thank you. Questions, board members? Mr. Char.
I'd like a little bit more background from maybe Russell on the nature of these particular leases. Are there any requirements, for instance, that it that subsequent lessees be descendants? And I'm looking at the provision also that Guy Ka'ai, who is one of the heirs, also has a lot 23, but I'm not sure whether what the status of that lease is.
I think staff reported on that one. I'm not sure if that's the one, but some of the lots, this is in a valley area, and they were issued out to be leased, but some of the lots, the tenants have a hard time developing for various reasons. Some of it may be the soil condition, or another factor too is the fire insurance as well. Yeah, is my understanding. So I'm not sure if he's a tenant, but if he is a tenant of a lease, that still would not prohibit him from acting as a personal rep on a relative's different parcel lease. Yeah.
I guess I'm somewhat familiar. This is an area, looks like at the bottom of Tantalus, going up to Tantalus or on top. But for instance, there are three vacant lots, and then the location was Guy Ka'ai got lot 23, but couldn't get financing. And then there's also reference that there's vegetation on the lot. And there are three vacant lots. I understand this particular request, but is there, for instance, a requirement that the people who are lessees live on the lot?
The intent was to live on the lot. As far as a requirement, I'm looking at my land agent here, Barry Chung, he's nodding yes. There is a requirement that they reside on the lot. And he just handed me a note that Guy's lease was canceled.
So is that one of the three leases that is vacant?
Yeah. Yes.
Are these, is this property, for instance, on the vacant leases, are they open for public auction, or are they, is this area restricted to the people who have originally lived in that valley?
To some extent, yeah, that's the language of the legislation that started this, these leases. Yeah, so they were issued by, I believe, drawing, Barry? Was it drawing? Was it direct negotiation?
So what's going to happen with the vacant lots, for instance?
My district is working with the community association to see if they can come up with a plan for the vacant lots.
But why is that? I mean, is there a vested right to a group of people for this property so that the land's not available for other purposes?
That's my understanding. In the legislation itself, yes.
Yeah, I wonder if we could get some better clarification. For instance, now that the there's a request to permit the inheritance by the heirs, is it the intention that all four of those people are going to be living on that property?
So, Mr. Char, they do actually all live on the property right now. So Guy and Dale is a husband and wife. Lane, Noel Lane is his son. And they all reside at the leasehold property.
Okay. I guess from my perspective for this request per se, that I have no objection to this particular permission to permit the inheritance by the heirs, but I am interested in a greater background as to, for instance, whether there are requirements that people in that valley be from the original family, what's going to happen with the vacant lots, whether it is available, and is this, again, just a matter of inheritance? Are they able to sell these lots once they're there to an outsider? I'd like to know a little bit more about...
The answer is no, Board Member Char. No, my understanding is no. It has to be, because this is one of the many acts passed over the years in the history of the department where we call it, it's in a way, special legislation to try to accommodate certain purposes. We've had similar ones in Kikala Keaukea, which was, the purpose was for helping the displaced volcanic victims of who were in bothered by the volcanic eruption of whatever year that was in. And so they were allowed to, the state spent money developing an area on the Big Island, and they were allowed to participate in a drawing, but they had to qualify in order to be part of that drawing. Could I get one of those leases? The answer is no. Mauna Laha, if my understanding, and I haven't looked at the act a long time, but there is an act that the legislature passed that, if I recall, maybe council might remember better than I do, especially, I thought it was about for those a long time ago, they were residing in this area or living on this area. And so the idea was to retain that heritage and formally document it in the term of a lease. And so that was my recollection of the genesis. Council, correct me if I'm wrong on the history.
No, you're correct. And it's Act 225 from 1981. I believe it's attached as Exhibit B to the submittal.
Oh, you're right, yeah.
Okay, I guess, for instance, how many residents are there in that subdivision area currently? And how is rent determined? The rent looks fairly modest, $120, for the land. And are there requirements for improvements? Is there any further background on that?
Yeah, the rents are at a relatively low, yes, you're right. And they were set by the terms of the board whenever the lease was entered into, I cannot recall. But we can probably come back with more information on it. I'm not prepared to answer all of the questions on the whole general vicinity of the area and the history of it. It has a history. Mauna Loa has a history to value.
Okay. I for one would like to get more information. It can either be informally in discussions with Russell or brought back to the board, but I'd like some better definition on that entire area, because I think it's right by the Nature Center, if I'm not mistaken, also.
Yes, and by our DOFA base yard in that area. Yes, we have a base yard.
There's a stream and there are bridges over
the
lots there.
Yes.
I have an interest in that entire area, but for this particular request, I have no objection.
And for those of you, historically, I mean, in 2006, there was some major rains. If you recall, the 48 days of rains, and this place was extremely hard hit. The slope, it started affecting the stability of the highway. So DLNR and said engineering division spent quite a bit of money trying to stabilize the slope in this area. Yeah, But this area has a history beyond my term, yeah. So we'd have to dig it up, and we can certainly get back to you, board member Char, on the side or through a board meeting, whichever the board prefers. Yeah.
Yeah. Either way.
Can I just make sure I understand what the exact action is here? So the previous action. So is there a house on the first lot? The first lease and no house on the second one, is that right?
There was that was canceled that was not able to be.
It was canceled in 20.
Yes.
Okay, so
in 2017, so the original action.
So the one that's the subject of this now has a house on it, and the lease allows for assignment, and so we're just approving the assignment to family members who continue to live there.
Family members.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions, board members? All right, and there is no further there's no other testimony on this. So somebody want to make a motion to approve?
I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve the action proposed by the staff.
Second.
Okay, all right, all in favor say aye.
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 All right, that is unanimous. Thank you very much, Mr. Kotak.
Thank you.
Alrighty. Okay, that's it on the land division. Thank you, Russell. We'll move to, anybody need a break? Nope. Okay, we'll go on to state parks. We'll do a little change out here. We have Sang in here too. Should I let him in? Alan?
Well, I can start and then we can see if Sang needs to join, but you can let him in.
And we have no other participants and no written testimony on this matter.
Okay. Shall I proceed?
I think Sang is connected now, so yes. Can you hear us, Sang? All right, I think he's good. All right, go ahead, Alan.
Okay, good morning, Chair. Good morning, board members. We are returning to you today to request approval for final adoption of our proposed amendments and compilation of HAR 13146-6, which is our fee increase across the board for camping and lodging, pavilion rental fees, parking and entrance fees for designated state park areas after a public hearing. You may recall we came to you in February 28th, to be exact, to to request, we presented the fees as they are still presented, to request going out to public hearing, that's legally required. We subsequently held that hearing on July 6th. We received, it was a virtual hearing for the first time, I think, in administrative rulemaking history, and it was understandably awkward, but we did receive 5 testimonies in support and some questions, which we clarified. We subsequently went back to the Small Business Regulatory Review Board for their regular meeting on July 16th. They approved it and forwarded their approval to the Lieutenant Governor, which is what we are seeking to do the same, should you approve us moving forward.
Thank you. All right, questions, board members? Comments, Mr. Char.
Are the revenues that will be derived devoted to a specific park, or is there a general fund that it goes into?
So revenues that we generate are deposited into the state park special fund, and certain parks, such as Diamond Head, have a legislative requirement that a percentage, I believe, is 55% of the funds generated at that park are returned to that park. We do not have a specific designation for the other ones, but they do all presently get deposited into the State Park Special Fund, which is for our own use and management. Of course, when these fees are gonna start appearing again is anyone's guess. So this is, we would like to, once the economy does open back up, we hope to have these in place across the board so we don't have to transition. It looks like the timing is gonna allow that.
Is that a change on, for instance, Diamond Head and parking? I thought residents were also currently paying whatever that parking fee was. So as I look at it, are residents now going to be given free parking?
Correct. So Diamond Head was the lone anomaly in our fee charging system across state parks for parking and or entry. And so we, with the increase across the board, we won't have to rely quite as heavily on Diamond Head, which was, was our cash cow with the largest attendance that we have. So it's a give back to local residents. So we're making it free for local residents to enter all parks across our system.
Is that going to affect the concessionaire doing the parking at, for instance, at Diamond Head because of the change in the fee system?
Saying?
There'll be an effect, but we assume it's going to be fairly nominal with the additional increase in fees. With that said, we are talking with all the parking and entry concessionaires to readjust all the terms in light of the increase in fees so they wouldn't get an unreasonable windfall with, the increase. And so that's pending.
Okay.
Other questions, board members?
I have a kind of trivial question. You said that there was the virtual public hearing, and what was the attendance?
Oh, it was in the teens to the 20s, if I'm not mistaken. Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah, it was about it fluctuated between about 17 to 20, low 20s.
And how does that compare to when you have public hearings in a regular, in-person public hearing?
I guess the truest comparison would be the last time we went out to enact our fees. It was, I think, 10 years ago. And I'm fairly certain we had zero attendance at each, and we held it on 5 islands, right? So a little better.
Yeah, it's interesting. I find that interesting because it has been true that in the recent past, public hearings were attended, but sometimes really dismal. So this was actual improvement.
Indeed, it was. Yeah.
Thank you. Other questions? No further questions, no testimony.
Move to approve.
Thank you.
Second.
Second, thank you. Mr. Oi, are you voting or you have a comment? Okay, voting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right, thank you. That passes unanimously. Congratulations, you folks that have been working really hard on.
Thanks so much. Someday we'll be able to collect the fees. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
At least the fees will be in place when you do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Mahalo.
Thank you. We're gonna take a 10-minute break. We'll be back at 10:35.
Mahalo.
right, we ready to come back in session? See, I want to just double check that Mr. Gomes is here still and Mr. Morris.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you. Got it. All right, thank you. We're going to move on to F1. Go ahead, Maria.
Sure. Aloha, board. Nice to see all your faces. Maria Carnevale, States Manager for Papahanaumokuakea. Item F1 is the request for authorization to issue a conservation and management permit. It's to Mr. Andrew Rochelot. This is for sea engineering for salvage activities of a NOAA weather buoy that is up at Lisianski Island. So there's a lot of detail in the submittal along with an approved salvage plan. It's the product of planning and a lot of conversations over the last couple of years. The buoy itself ran outside the watch circle out of Kauai on March 28th, 2018. It then entered Papahanaumokuakea's boundaries in the fall of that year. And since then, we have been working with the Buoy Center as the responsible party, who then contracted Sea Engineering to perform this salvage. So a couple updates just since the submittal's been written. MNB, our Monument Management Board, has endorsed this permit by consensus. And then due to COVID and personnel health and safety concerns, DAR has decided not to send an agency representative on this trip. So what we're doing instead to help with that on-site decision-making is really work. I know some of you have been a part of trips to Papahanaumokuakea in the past, and we do a lot of pre-access briefing. So we're gonna continue, you know, the 2 years of discussions that we've had with this salver and continue to brief them up as much as we can in terms of, you know, pathways to get to the buoy and the chain and just really situational awareness for the island. And really just set this group up for success. They have performed a salvage in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands a few years back. Some of you were on the board at the time when there was a hulied vessel up at Kiri Atoll. So we definitely have confidence in working with this organization. And then we're also gonna work with our partners. We were planning on doing, using an ROV and doing some underwater footage of the area. We have worked with our sanctuaries office, our partners. They've done some initial surveys and we're looking at, you know, future logistics to get some DAR staff up there to also look on site. So unfortunately, we won't be able to have someone for this trip, but I think a lot of the components and the value of having that person, we can try to mitigate as much as possible. So with that, I don't think the applicants were able to join us this morning, but I'm happy to answer from what I can.
Thank you. Questions, board members? Chris?
It's just a comment. I don't see a great urgency in this. But I wanted to be sure that the staff felt that they, in a true, in a situation where there was urgency to act on a salvage, which I think would often be the case, that or you don't have to bring it to the board.
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually have that listed throughout our management documents, that the initial kind of emergency piece of any situation that happens remotely up in the Northwesterns, where there is an afforded time for planning, like definitely act. But when something's kind of up there and we're figuring out how to get it off and there's like contracts in place and details can be kind of negotiated and thought through, then that's the place where we really put our effort, and we have the time to figure it out.
That's all I have. Thank you. I'm
good. Okay. Any other questions, comments, board members? If not, somebody want to make a motion to approve?
Move to approve.
Second.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That passes unanimously with no public testimony. Thank you very much.
Mahalo.
All right. We're moving on to F2. Okay, I think that was who signed up to be here. So I will note we have 10 items of written testimony on this. And aquatic resources, you wanna go ahead? Whoever's gonna go present this.
Yep, thank you. Good morning, Chair and board members. This is David Sakota, program manager with DAR. Agenda item F2 is a request for approval to hold a public meeting and hearing to amend and compile Chapter 13-34 HAR, the Pupukea Marine Life Conservation District. The primary purpose of this amendment is to include the tide pool area within the boundaries of the MLCD. That was the original intent when it was first established, but because that parcel was yield to the county, we couldn't incorporate it initially into the MLCD. And so in 2008, the governor at the time yielded it back to the state, and we have not done this rulemaking since then. So finally we're getting around to it. And you know, while we're doing that, there's also some technical amendments that we wanna make just to clarify the rules. We also want to prohibit the feeding of marine life, as we do in other MLCDs, just because it's bad for the ecosystem. And we're also clarifying the penalties and adding an asset forfeiture provision, which we already have the authority for, but we need to put it in our rule chapters. So we're doing that as we go. That pretty much sums it up, and happy to answer any questions the board might have.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Questions, board members? Sam?
Well, I have a question. I presume then that the public hearing is going to be virtual, as was the case for another item on the agenda?
Yes, that's correct. I think in the submittal, we had requested it to be in or near Pupukea, but because of COVID-19, we will be holding a virtual public hearing online.
Okay, other questions?
I was kind of curious actually on how you promulgate the invitation to public hearing under these new conditions. What do you guys do?
Well, the public notice requirement under Chapter 91 remains the same. So it's a publication in a statewide newspaper at least 30 days in advance. And then we also post it on our website and do a news release a couple weeks before so that the public is aware of it.
Yeah, that sounds like covering the bases, news release in particular.
Okay, other questions of aquatic resources? Any, no questions I see. We have Denise Antolini. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Case and members of the board.
Did you want to offer testimony?
Shall I proceed?
Please do.
Yes, I would love to. Thank you. Good morning, Aloha Chair Case and members of the board. My name is Denise Antolini. I have been privileged to serve as the volunteer president of Malama Pupukea Waimea on the north shore of Oahu since its formation 16 years ago. As many of you know, we focus our stewardship efforts on protecting the spectacular and abundant Pupukea MLCD, which is about 100 acres of state waters stretching from Waimea Bay to the area known as Shark's Cove or Kulalua Point. It's only one of only three MLCDs on Oahu. Please refer to this beautiful map that DAR included in your submittal as Exhibit A to give yourself an overview of the boundaries of the MLCD. We are truly grateful that DAR has prepared this submittal to the board today. All of the housekeeping amendments that David Sakota referred to are important and long overdue, and none should be controversial. We believe all the testimony today is in support in your packet, including from DOCARE, our wonderful Makai Watch partner. I will focus now for just 1 minute on the proposed boundary correction for the tide pools, which will finally, formally, and legally include the tide pools, also known as kapo'o, into the administrative rules that govern the MLCD. As David Sakota mentioned, the corrected boundaries and map will allow enforcement, DOCARE, to enforce the rules that protect the rest of the MLCD in the tide pools. And also, if you got a chance to thoroughly read your submittal, if you look in footnote 5, it explains that the board actually approved this action in 2008. So more than 12 years ago, this board did the same thing, and that resulted in the executive orders in 2009, but the rules have never been amended. So we're here today to ask for you to do that. Last point, as the scientific testimony indicates to you, recent studies of the tide pools by first-rate scientists indicate this area, which is about the size of 2.5 football fields, provides a unique shallow water protected habitat and really is a pu'uhonua for marine life that supports the entire MLCD and spillover beyond. The tide pools are full of life and connected to the rest of the MLCD, and it makes no sense not to have them protected. While we have awaited this rule change very patiently, it's been frustrating and heartbreaking to watch blatant take of marine life from this nursery area and to know that the state and the community are powerless to stop it. We do our best to educate and explain pono practices, but ultimately the state, DOCARE, and the community need enforceable rules. So in closing, we ask that you approve this housekeeping package of rule amendments, move it forward to public hearing. We're excited to go to a virtual public hearing in response to Member Gahn's comments. I think it's very appropriate, and we really appreciate your support. Mahalo.
Thank you very much. And thank you for all your work on this, and thank you for your encouragement to get this wrapped up. It's a good opportunity right in the middle of COVID for us all to be able to concentrate on it, and really appreciate your support for that. Questions, comments, board members? Jimmy, you're on.
Move to approve. Wait. If not.
Jimmy's got a comment.
I just want to echo your feelings, the same thing to Ms. Antolini, of her hard work and with their community and their help and their group. I think this is a great project. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Others? Okay. Sam?
Move to approve.
Second.
All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye, that passes unanimously. Thank you very much. Good luck on the hearing, and hope we can wrap it up pretty quickly here.
Awesome.
Thank you. Okay, we're gonna go to D3 now.
Is that F3, Chair?
I'm sorry, F3.
All in favor, say aye.
Janine, can you turn off your YouTube? So, good morning again, board members, David Sakota, Wardara. I'd like to introduce Janine Rasa, who's the acting co-manager for the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary for item F3. the non-decision-making briefing on the final management plan for the Hawaiian Island Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary. Janine?
Aloha, everybody. Thank you, David, for the introduction. So as David said, I'm the acting co-manager for the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Sanctuary. And because this is a public record, I also want to say that I'm contracted to DAR through UH's Social Science Research Institute and Hickory. So my official title there is Sanctuary Planner, just because of this public.
Sorry, Jeannie, hang on. You got a little bandwidth issue here.
On the Hawaiian Island Humpback Whale.
Jeannie, maybe you should turn off your video, actually. All right. Yeah. Try it again. Try it again. You're back. You just froze up for a little while there. So
okay.
We heard your introduction and we heard your reference to University of Hawaii. And then then you froze going into the substance.
Okay. The substance is that I'm here to brief you on the new sanctuary management plan. And you don't need to approve it. We're just reading so that you know what is in it. And instead of going through the handouts that I prepared for you, I thought that I would actually give you a PowerPoint so you could better visualize the activities of the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale Sanctuary staff, because rather than going through it, you might be able to see what it is that they do, because that's what's in the plan. So
great.
I'm going to share my screen. Does that sound like a plan?
Make sure you can.
Okay. Tell me when I'm ready to do this. And I'm a Zoom newbie, so
hopefully this will work.
Is the share screen option in green down below at the bottom of your screen?
Yes, it is. Okay.
Yeah, try it. Go ahead and try it. Got it.
Oh, great.
Okay. Oops. All right. So, the new management plan for the sanctuary. So, the mission of the sanctuary, of course, is to protect humpback whales and their habitat. And they do that through conservation, research, education, and outreach. And you're going to see those same themes in the plan. So just to kind of give a little bit of context, and I'm sure all of you know this, but just to get everybody on that same page, and because I'm a community college teacher in past life, so these things happen, to give us an idea of like, why do we even have the sanctuary? And what happened in the 50s and 60s is that after World War II, commercial whaling in the United States just exploded. It was so much easier for people to harvest whales, and you know, all of our whale populations were devastated by over 90%. It's a huge public outcry. Those of you who were in the 70s remember the Save the Whale campaigns. And in 1992, Congress passed the Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary Act, authorizing the sanctuary and identifying that ONMS, Office of National Marine Sanctuaries, would run it. We had public meetings around Hawaii at that time because the sanctuary includes both state and federal waters. And in 1997, that was approved by Governor Kaitana, who also set the boundaries at the time and required that there be co-management of the state. So here's some of our new maps that we just got made, showing you the extent of the sanctuary around Hawaii. So you can see that the primary area is Maui Nui, no surprise. And then Penguin Banks off to the left there of Molokai, a little bit to the north, and the southern end of Oahu, a little bit off of Kauai, and then of course off of the Kohala coast of Big Island. One thing to note is on the blown up piece there, the highlighted area around Maui Nui, that the sanctuary does not include harbors. So we've got some new maps now that show the actual edge of the sanctuary around the harbor areas. Okay. So some of the co-management stipulations, and this is from the compact agreement that was made between NOAA and the state, that no state or local funding is required to manage the sanctuary, meaning the co-manager position does not require state money. That money is given to us by ONMS for this position. So it doesn't cost us anything to have this position at the sanctuary. And again, the governor gets to designate that state employee, actually Suzanne, and that will resolve any policy differences. There are other things too. So how does the sanctuary actually help the state of Hawaii? Like, why do we as a board and an agency care? It's all about the whales. So first off, I want to say that humpbacks are culturally very important. Kohala are mentioned, oh my gosh, I forgot the kahoko, apologies. Kohala are mentioned early in the Kumulipo. And Sam, I'm sure, can speak more to that than I can. But my understanding is the earlier it is, the more foundational that animal or plant is in the whole cosmology of Hawaiian thought. The Kohala are also the kinolau or physical manifestation of the god Kanaloa. This is a really big deal because Kanaloa himself is the ocean itself, is ocean currents, is ocean winds, is oceanic depths. So the whale being who it is in those depths, it's an enormous deal that it is the kinolau of Kanaloa. He's also the god of sailing canoe navigation and is therefore tied inextricably to the island of Kahoolawe because that was a traditional navigation training center. So very important. Humpbacks are also economically important to us as a state. There was a study in 1999, so some years ago, but when you convert that to today's dollars, whale watching alone, so people just going on whale watching trips, is 30 to 42 million coming in. And if you add in the dinner cruises and snorkeling tours, that's another 120 to 200 million in today's dollars. And the reason why we can add those in is because in this study in 1999, which was done by a presidential management fellow who was working at the sanctuary at the time, did an extensive survey of tourists, and 75% of them said that they go on the dinner cruises and snorkeling tours because they know they're going to see whales. I should also point out that those amounts are greater than, I think, what did I figure out? It was greater than like coffee, macadamia nuts, and sport fishing combined. It's a significant thing. And then whales are ecologically important. So sorry, I'm going to get a little teachery here on you, little graphics. Think about whales as a giant package of nutrients coming from Alaska and bringing those nutrients to Hawaii. So remember that our marine system is nutrient poor, which is very common for subtropical areas. And so whales are coming in, they're eating there, not so much here, but so they're defecating, that's putting nutrients in, and they're also giving birth. And the little shark icon is that some studies have been done to show that the afterbirth from those 1,000 mother whales giving birth is a huge food source, iron rich and easy to digest for sharks especially, and I'm sure many other marine creatures. In addition, whales shed their skin every single day. Not all of them are often like nibbling on whales and follow them around. So, you know, that's providing food for our own fishes. And it's not crazy to think that we've got seabirds then feeding on fishes, which have now more nutrients. We've got whales dying and the baby whales dying. That's also providing food into the system. And all of that ultimately ends up in our forests. All of it ultimately ends up in our streams. So, although we haven't done any work on that part of the whole trophic system, there has been a bit of a shirt cuff sketch of how many nutrients whales put into the system, and my little notes here. You know, we're looking at like 3,000 tons of biomass alone from whales coming in at a particular time during the year. So it's important. Okay, let's talk about the management plan. There's four action plans in it: research and monitoring, education and outreach, living cultural heritage, and administration and management. Basically, the important takeaway, and I'll go through all these, but is that it's the same as what's in the 2002 plan, and they're doing the same thing they've already been doing. There are no boundary changes, and there's no regulation changes. So that's very important to understand. Okay, so research and monitoring. Here's some pictures of some of the things they do with this. One of our main programs is using acoustics. And I've got a little globe on the side of it to indicate that this is actually a globally recognized leader. I mean, the staff is globally recognized in the work that they do here. So, okay. So in terms of using acoustics, we're looking at singing whales. As you all know, humpback whales are known for their song. And that's the male whales that sing, not the females. The females, of course, communicate with their calves and communicate with each other, but that's a famous song.
Sorry, I'm in a meeting right now, so just go for it.
Okay, it's thought to,
the shower,
it's thought that the whales do not sing to
the species cow. Came on, bro. Okay.
Oh, he didn't really. It's okay. So it's not necessarily to attract females, but more to communicate to other males their fitness level and you know, status in the hierarchy. So one of the questions we had in terms of population, sorry, I'm jumping into the middle of that, is if we're recording over only males, is that a good enough indicator of the whole population? As you can imagine, it's actually really hard to figure out exactly how many whales we have here every year, because we've only got one monitoring station on Maui at Oluwalu, and then another one on the Big Island, and the whales move around all over the place. So how do you get a snapshot every year unless you went archipelago-wide with a whole bunch of people at the same time, which costs money? So the work that they've done, they've found that they've actually got a pretty good relationship between the volume, so to speak, of whale song and the number of whales of any gender and age in the area. The folks on the side with the theodolite are actually counting whales. And then I don't have another one here. There's also a boat that goes out and counts whales at the same time with looking at the acoustics. Moving on. They also tag whales to find out what they're doing at night and follow them. You also see the wave glider down at the bottom, which got up to the Northwest Hawaiian Islands to listen for whale song and determine if we had whales up there. And indeed we do, more than we thought, and in places that we did not know they were. Okay. We also use a lot of photo identification, and I'm using the sanctuary weed now, so the dartweed, sorry, that happens. And as you know, whale flukes, you can individually identify whales. So we take a look at all the individuals coming back every year and have a partnership with an organization that helps us track that using facial recognition software. We're going out in boats all the time. You can see that he's got a GoPro on a camera to look underneath the whales, and sometimes they are getting into the water. They're also looking at, do the whales have whale lice on them? Are they skinny? Do they have scars from boats? Do they have scars from fighting? Do they have scars from nets? About 50% of our whales have had some sort of interaction with a boat or gear at some point in their lives. A big part of what we do, or a really important part of what we do, is rescue operations. It's not big, but it's a big deal. Whales get tangled in nets. Sometimes it's through their baleen. Sometimes it's impeding flippers. Sometimes they drag it all the way from Alaska. And we've got a very, very highly trained crew that goes out and removes the gear from the whales. They use a special grapple hook to catch on to the gear, tie on to the gear, they're not hooked into the whale, and then slowly work to use special knives to cut the gear off the whale. We also do a lot of education and outreach with, this is Kapa'a High School in Kauai, who just won an award for being Ocean Guardians. There's another school on Big Island lined up for this year. The folks also do education and community events with schools. You'll see our little inflatable whale there. During the COVID thing, our educational lead, Patty Miller, set up her living room and did a whole bunch of educational videos through Waikiki Aquarium. And we have a citizen science work every year, which includes a big whale count that happens on all the islands. So what else is in the plan is also, this is the new one, which is a living cultural heritage plan. And this is primarily two parts. One is to have cultural practitioners and educators work with the staff at the sanctuary to educate the staff about Hawaiian cultural traditions and practices. And the second part of it is, how can we incorporate more of that into what the sanctuary does? And then last, of course, it is administration and management. We have two visitor centers, one on Kauai, one on the Ocean Discovery Center, one at Kihei. We have an army of volunteers, only five federal employees, five contracted ones, me, and a giant army. And of course, we have our advisory committee up there at the top of the slide. So my takeaways are, just so that you understand as the board, that humpback whales are really important to the people of Hawaii and therefore important to us. That the sanctuary itself is key to protecting whales and their habitat. Having the sanctuary and what it, the work that its staff does. And that, you know, we as an agency, like, we're proud of this. We're committed to this work here at the sanctuary. And I'm really privileged and honored to be a part of it. Okay.
Terrific. Thank you, Janine, very much for that briefing, and including all the great pictures always really helps a lot. I see we have Alan Tom here as well.
Yes.
In the room. Alan, did you want to add anything? Let's see if he's...
Well, aloha board. I am Alan Tom. I'm the federal sanctuary superintendent. I'm based on Maui. This really is to come to the board. It is a courtesy, and we probably should have been doing this more often. The sanctuary has been in Hawaii 23 years, and it's only now that I think we really need to ramp up our state co-partnership, which is really to include you in all of our discussions. And as Suzanne knows, this is just really trying to put the finishing touches on a milestone of our management plan review. So that's what this plan really is.
Thank you. Good to see you. Thank you for all your work on the sanctuary, both of you, very much. Okay, questions, board members?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Sam, go ahead and then Chris.
I was wondering whether or not there's a, do you have a Facebook presence or social media presence where people can go and see the plan and or an easy place on the web that people can review the details that you shared with us? Those are awesome. That was an awesome presentation. Mahalo for that.
Yes, there's a really nice website. It just got redone by the sanctuary, by NOAA. And it's, if you just, I forget what the exact address is, but you'll find it on there. And the plan will be on that site. That awesome. What's happening in terms of the timing is that the sanctuary staff, and Alan, you can jump in if you need to, is waiting for you to be briefed and be okay with this plan. Then their people that format it and make it all pretty will do their magic, and then it'll get loaded up. So they're thinking middle of September. So I'll just keep you all. I'll let Suzanne know, and she can let you know when it's available.
Thank you. And I do see that the presentation is posted along with the agenda in case anyone wants to look at it in more detail. Actually, that's the, it says presentation, but it's the plan itself.
Oh, okay. So
the... I'm sorry. It's just the label of the link in the agenda item. Yeah. Okay. Other, Chris, you want to go ahead?
Under this plan, are there differences in the regulations for compact whales between the sanctuary area and the non-sanctuary areas around the Hawaiian Islands?
In other words, because whales are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, regardless of where they are?
Well, I'm asking, are there additional regulations? There are certainly lots of regulations that protect whales outside, right. In all waters, really, whether it's in the sanctuary right. or not. And there are things like how close you come to them and,
right.
you know, aside from you can't, like, go shoot one or something. Regulations inside the sanctuary as opposed to outside the sanctuary?
And Alan, there's additional fines if you.
So the only difference to answer Chris's question is that there is no difference when you cross that imaginary boundary out in the ocean. The only difference within the sanctuary is that the possibility of a penalty if you are caught harassing a humpback whale within the sanctuary, the violation could increase. But the actual regulation, the 100-yard approach rule, exists outside mm-hmm. the sanctuary as well.
Mm-hmm. And is the enforcement the same, basically, between inside the sanctuary as outside the sanctuary? The same people enforce it, and the same is the same violation of the same agency? Okay.
Correct.
The sanctuary does not have its own enforcement staff.
Okay. There was an announcement, some months ago of a proposed rule that would include additional species within the sanctuary and possibly extend the boundaries. This has nothing, there's no relationship between this action and that action.
Well, that action was about 4 years ago. but since then, NOAA has pulled back and decided we are not going to move forward with that idea. And so the answer is no.
Okay. Time passes very quickly.
especially now that we're all at home. Yes, correct.
So that's why this new plan is tiered off the 2002 plan. It doesn't yes. come out of that old process.
Okay.
That was done.
I always appreciate informational briefings when we actually are not in the loop of saying thumbs up or thumbs down, but who does make the decision on whether to adopt the management plan, this proposed new management plan?
Well, ONMS will make that decision. And Alan and I were just talking about this before, and I've also talked about it with David and the ONMS staff, is that in the past, DLNR has not signed these plans, but it doesn't mean that we can't in the future. Just we haven't ever done it before. So at this point for this plan, ONMS is really anxious to get it out the door and be done with it, but it doesn't mean that we can't do it in the future if we'd like to do that as a co-managing agency. So, So you understand, sorry to interrupt briefly, that Alan and I worked really closely together on this plan. So we as an agency, DLNR, were very instrumental in writing it and the content of what's in it.
Right, so ONMS is the Office of National Marine Sanctuaries. So we are the ones that are sort of like, hey, this thing is 3 years overdue. We need to put it to bed. But that's why we have a state co-manager, is the state co-manager flags anything that could possibly be a concern to the state. She runs it up her chain. If at any time putting this plan together, DLNR as the state lead said, oh, this is not going to fly, we would have changed it and come up with something else. So that's how our partnership would work, or does work.
Okay.
Other questions, comments, board members? Okay, well, thank you so much for your work on this. It's really nice to
so
get
easy.
To this.
Gosh. Thank you so much.
Back to getting a good solid co-management plan going forward and wrapping this up. And, you know, obviously it's a very special place and sanctuary and creature for Hawaii. And we really appreciate all of your work to protect it and help us share it carefully with the world. Okay, thank you so much. Okay, we're gonna move on to item G1.
I'm gonna close this now. Place and sanctuary and creature. And we really appreciate all of your work to protect it and help us share it carefully with the world. Okay, thank you so much.
Now, Les and Mike, if you have YouTube on, you have to turn it off now.
We just did. Can you hear us?
Okay.
All right.
Great. All right.
Hey.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Case and members of the board. Mike Imanaka, our deputy registrar, and myself, Les Kobata. We don't have very many opportunities to get in front of you folks, so we are relishing this opportunity to do so. We have hopefully what's going to be a pretty easy matter. We are seeking the board's blessing and approval to provide some very critical industry data that we have been already providing, but prior to this, it had been provided by a third party. We are looking to take that responsibility on with the upgrade of our land record system. That was actually the last time I came before the board, was to make sure we would get your blessing to do that. So that project is well underway, and we're anticipating much greater capabilities and efficiencies with the bureau's operation, and ultimately to be able to provide many more services, or at least improve services to the public. So again, the key thing right now is where we are providing these information services through a company called Hawaii Information Consortium. When we convert to our land record system, which is now anticipated because of COVID, we've had delays. It was originally going to be October, but we're looking at a January conversion now. When we are converted over to our system, then we will be providing current services to our existing customers directly, as opposed to the third party. And then we're also looking down the road to be able to not only improve on the services we provide, but also to be able to provide new services to the public. So our request is pretty straightforward. It's to get, again, the board's blessing and approval to continue, obviously, to provide those types of services to our customers for the appropriate fees, because they are fee-based services, and also to get the approval to develop new services and also to improve, obviously, existing services for the appropriate fees. Open to any questions that the board members may have.
Thank you very much. Okay, questions, board members.
Yeah, Les, this is Kaili. Regarding the fee structure, I would imagine, is there a tiered fee structure for this new system?
It actually is not a tiered fee structure. Let me maybe start with explaining what the current fee structure is. Most of the general public will go into our website and search and purchase documents. That's done on a per page basis. Then we have the next level of customers. Let's call them attorneys. Attorneys' offices, who do more searching. So it makes more sense for them to be able to purchase a monthly subscription. So they do that. They pay a monthly subscription and are able to search and print as many pages of documents as they want. And then we have the high-end users, if you will, which would be our industry users, title escrow companies, financial services, credit bureaus. They download a ton load of information from us daily. That's at a flat rate. Just to give you an idea, we currently charge that highest tier, $500 a month. A peer organization, and I'll pick those in Minnesota. And I'm picking Minnesota in particular because they're one of the few states in the nation, along with Hawaii, that has two systems of recording. You might have heard the term land court, right? And then we also have what's called regular system. So Minnesota is really the only other state besides Hawaii that is fully land court and regular system. So we use that kind of as our test bed, you know, in terms of comparison. People there, so my counterparts there, one in particular that's about the same size as us, Hennepin County, they charge 15 cents an image. So I'm gonna do a little quick math for you. We do an average of 1,000 to 1,200 documents a day. So for easy math, I'm gonna say 1,000 documents. Our average document size is anywhere from 7 to 10 pages. So I'm gonna be conservative and go on the low side, 7 pages. That's 7,000 pages a day times 21 average business days. I gotta make sure I double check my math. Okay, so that comes up to, if I multiply by 15 cents an image, it's $22,000 a month that my counterpart in Hennepin County in Minnesota would be charging. Today, the Bureau charges $500 for the same thing. So we're in dire need of level setting our fees in that regard. And we don't expect to jump from 500 to 22,000, but we are definitely in need of increasing those fees, at the very least to cover our costs.
Yeah, and that's what I was trying to tease out. So thank you for the math and the comparison. The fee structure, is that gonna have to go through rules, or how does that work?
You know, we verified, at least did our best due diligence we could through the Attorney General's office. We are very fortunate that we get very immediate and complete support from our Attorney General's office, specifically because we have a lot of oddball type things that come up with the Bureau. But this is one area that we did search out to see if there was any rule that applies to these sort of fees, and we could find no rules that apply to this, which is actually why there's not even necessarily a precedent for us to come to the board to get this approval, but we felt that was a responsible, you know, action at the very least, which is why we're doing this now.
I see, thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Why did it take so long to do this?
That is a darn good question, Mr. Gomes. Can I start by saying I've been here 8 years? So part of it is getting caught up with a lot of these things. And only in the last 3 years have I been the registrar here. But there has been no question and acknowledgement that we had the need to increase those fees. And I don't have any good reason to tell you why we haven't done it sooner. But one thing that is pushing this effort right now is that it ties very well with the upgrade of our land record system. That gives us two things. One is gonna give us the ability to be able to manage that process of providing the services directly that we previously used a third party for. And secondly, obviously with the new expenses we're taking on with the land record system, I think it's a very appropriate time for us to start recovering some of those costs.
So do you think by not using the third party, you will be able to give the public a better product? Or a better response?
We believe so, although I'll be very honest, our third party has also been very responsive in terms of the services that they were providing on our behalf. But the biggest change that the third party, not elimination, but where the third party is no longer involved, is they were managing our land record system. We are moving to a new vendor, yeah, with this upgrade of the land record system. And with the upgrade of the land record system, many of the things that have to be supported by the third party vendor are no longer needed. We can support ourselves directly in that front. So yes, I'd like to think we're gonna provide better service because now it's a direct conduit to us and the public. And the more important thing is that we're gonna be able to provide enhanced and newer services than we had previously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, other questions? Board members, questions, comments?
How many subscribers do you have at this $500 a month level?
We have 10. I believe it's 7 of them are local and then 3 of them are mainland.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was surprised it's that many because I just, in my head, I don't really have, I thought, you know, this sounds like a title company thing that they would subscribe to. I guess a law firm might subscribe to it too. They're just, how many title companies are active now in the state?
Mr. Yuen, there are 4, and I'm trying to remember from, I apologize, it's a little bit from memory. 4 title companies, if I'm not mistaken, 3 local information service providers. For example, when I say information service provider, that those information service providers, their main audience is the real estate sector. So realtors and related companies, and mortgage companies, things like that. And I believe it was 3 other financial or credit bureau type companies. Those are the main ones.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. I mean, you would wonder about us being just, you know, more known for our real estate related information, but very much tied to that mortgage industry and the credit bureaus are very dependent on the information that we provide them. And obviously the speed at which we provide it and the accuracy of that information. Because what they're using that for is to determine your credit worthiness, basically to get your loan and to see what other, you know, liens might be associated with your name and things to determine what they can and cannot provide you.
And if I'm, tell me if I'm understanding this right, that at the $200 level, you get the search of the index for the last 7 days. And at the $500 level, you also get, at the $200 level, you pay for the documents per page that you request. And at the $500 level, you just automatically can get all the documents for free. Is that how it works? Did I miss anything?
Not exactly, Mr. Yuen. Okay, so let me just start it again at the higher tier. The highest tier, the $500 level today, is what we call a bulk download of images. What they're doing is every document that we record every day, that image is being put into a secure site, which they download. What those companies are doing, let's take the example of a title company. They're taking those documents and then taking the basic index we provided to them and then searching through that document and picking up other key pieces of information that they need so that they can produce one of the most basic things that the title company provides, which is a title report. Yeah, it gives the history and anything that might be associated either with an individual or more likely with a property, a particular property. The next level down, which I was saying the attorneys and all, I don't think I gave a price on that, but anyway, it's a subscription again for the attorneys. And those people would have, you're right, unlimited searching capability and then the ability to download those documents. The most basic tier is your day-to-day person. If you went to our website today and you wanted to get a copy of your mortgage, you would search by what we call grantor-grantee, which is basically your last name. And any document that's associated with the name that you've entered in there would pop up. So you would select the appropriate document and then download that and then pay the appropriate fees, which is $1 a page.
If I had the $500, I'm just getting the last 7 days. Every 7 days, I'm just getting the last 7 days, right? And then if I see a document that I want, like say, there's a deed referenced the last 7 days, like from 19, do I get that for free too, or do I have to order that separately and pay for it?
Okay, so in that $500 tier, I should clarify further, yeah? The information that they're downloaded is probably the rawest form of data. It's purely a download of PDF images that they're taking into their system and then manually reviewing to pull out the key pieces of information that they want. So to your point about, can I take the $500 level and basically find a specific document in the past 7 days or whatever it is, but can I find a specific document, let's say even for yesterday, because I just downloaded yesterday's 1,000 documents, and there's one particular document I was looking for. Would I have the ability to find it? No, not easily, because you're looking at PDF after PDF after PDF. Whereas the first two versions that I gave you, the attorney version and then the basic public version, there's a search engine behind it. So it makes it easier for you to put in UN, comma Chris, and then come up with something.
Wow.
The $500 version, you're just getting bulk data.
Well, so if they didn't want to re-index it themselves, they would have to wait, but you could. I mean, you could have both subscriptions, right? And then you would have your index done, and you wouldn't have to re-index it yourself, right?
What they would probably do, and we're going to be in a much better position to do this when we go to our new land record system, is that we can provide them specifically an index data download. So it's only the data, not the images. And then it's up to them within their systems how they want to marry them together. But today, if you took that $500 bulk image download, it's not user friendly, I guess.
Now, last time I searched your records online myself, and I do it for free, of course, you know, I don't have any of these subscriptions. They were indexed back to 1970. Is that still the limit? And is there any plan to start extending that backward in time?
I'm glad you asked that, Mr. Ewing. I guess once the last time we got in front of you was to get approval for us to spend money on our digitization project. So we're in phase 3 of 5 for digitizing everything that is in this office. And we've actually achieved that. But in the last two phases was where we needed to be able to massage that data and then put it in a format and onto a platform that was going to be user-friendly to allow you to search documents back to 1845. The quick answer is yes, we're planning to do it. The more complicated answer is as soon as we have the money.
Okay. Well, that's often the answer to. But I'm glad that you have a plan to do it. I'm going back even farther, but there was a time, you know, can you still, like pre-COVID, could you still go in? I think there was a microfiche in Bureau of Conveyance. I remember going through a microfiche of a grant or grantee. Does that still exist?
We had to donate the last true microfiche to the archives. No, we actually moved all of the old microfilm and microfiche equipment out. We don't really use microfiche anymore. We still do have microfilm though. And we still have two units in our office that allow you to digitally go through those and actually print off of much better than what we had before. Yeah, because for all of us who went to the University of Hawaii, the same thing that was at the basement of the Hamilton Library was we had 7 of those units in our office. Yeah. So we no longer have those. We have computers to replace them. And one of the beautiful things about getting to the point where we have everything now actually digitized, as I mentioned, but just not ready for public consumption. In our offices here, we do have a interim application that's put on the computers that are in our public reference room that allow you to digitally search everything in our library. Mm-hmm. So you will probably want to come down when we open up next, Mr. Yuen, so that you can, just out of for nostalgia's sake, look at a piece of microfilm, but then go to one of our computers and be able to do it digitally.
Well, this looking through the microfilm is not one of my great nostalgic experiences I want to recreate. And I'm happy to hear that, because that was going to be my next question, you know, really, that you could at least go to the office and do a grantor or grantee search that will take you back to 1845? Okay.
There's one or two extra steps because this app is like an interim, yeah. But one or two extra steps, but nonetheless, you don't have to touch any film.
Yeah. And those, again, I'm betraying how long it's been since I've been down in your office, and I welcome you to your, like, maybe once every 2 year land board visits. the books are still there, right? All those
big, the books are definitely there.
Big volumes in Hawaiian with people's actual signatures.
We have I'd be happy when the if there's anybody on the board that's interested in coming by and seeing some of the progression that we've gone through, mm-hmm. to include one of the next times we may come before you is again to get your blessing on some expenditures we want to make to start restoring some of those books, because they are really a treasure.
Yes,
that should not be lost. And so if there's a way that we can do it, we actually had one of our vendors supporting us provide us with a sample of what they can do. And it is amazing what they can do to restore these books and then to put them in a form that can last for the next 100 years.
Yeah. Well, this is another topic entirely, but to treat these as archival museum piece type materials that really have to be physically very well protected is like our long-term where we ought to go with them and look at them. They're not like the books in the library that that you can order from somebody else, but they're more like a book of Psalms from the 1700s that has somehow been preserved that is now a rare, belongs in a rare book collection practically.
I'm very happy to hear that, Ms. Ewan, because I think there may be some question on some folks, especially it is not an inexpensive proposition to try and restore these books. But I think they're well worth it. And I think over time, and as long as we can protect them as best we can, that was frankly 3 years back, the big push to digitize everything, because we could not afford to lose anything.
Absolutely.
There, even if it was going to be in a digital form, yeah, to be able to maintain that.
Okay,
so thank you for that sentiment.
Thanks for bringing this initiative to the board.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments?
Yeah, I have a quick question. Hey, I really love hearing about all this modernization, digitization, improvement in access, shifting from third party to direct service. It's awesome. But I'm wondering whether or not you have a plan to not really market it, but to show your the capabilities and the services that are available and how the public and others might be able to access it, just not only to promulgate that information more widely, but also as a means to make sure that the fees that you're collecting are maximized and come back into the department.
Thank you for asking that, Mr. Gunn. I think it's important for us to make sure that we highlight our good work. Yeah. So to your point, we've actually had very good support, first of all, from our public information officer, Dan Dennison. When we did our digitalization, he did a great piece on it, had it on our website, and did public press releases and things. We did the same thing when we did our land records upgrade, just to make sure everybody was knowing that we were spending money right and we're moving in the right direction. We want to continue at least that effort, right, to make sure that people know, especially if we're taking over the services and maybe there's newer services that we get that word out. From there, actually, what's interesting is we get pretty good word of mouth, because the audience that really pays attention to the work we do is a pretty small and focused audience. They're the industries that deal with us. So they get word pretty quickly about new things that we're doing or how we're getting them done. Besides that, in terms of the general public, really the only time the general public comes to us is I lost my mortgage, I got to do a refinance, I got to go to court. And so I would say that's 10% of the public So the question is going to be how well we should try and address 10% of the public versus making sure that the 10% that we do deal with, or the, at least the ones that we deal with regularly, are kept apprised of what we do. And within the industry, at least, we have pretty good contacts. Hawaii Land Title Association, they provide us about 70% of our business. That's the title and escrow companies. So we are very close with them in terms of education and information getting out. When it's appropriate, we try and get to the Bar Association too, to make sure, because that's our secondary group of people that access our documents. And again, the credit and financial industry is a pretty small segment, but they are very well aware because they deal with us pretty much on a day-to-day basis. So they're pretty much aware of how we go through it. So, you know, I can't say that we have a formal, you know, marketing plan to get that word out. The word of mouth has been pretty good so far, but I think that is something that we should probably consider more, and maybe we can get a little more help from Dan, you know, in dealing with Dan Dennison, to see if there's a better way that we can try and market that. And oh, by the way, our deputy Mike Imanaka was in that industry and was a marketing person in that industry, so I have an in-house resource that I know that I'm going to take advantage of as well.
Awesome. It's clear from your answer that you've obviously thought about this a lot, your audience and the potential market for the services that you're shifting over to.
I can't say I lose sleep over it, but we have given it a lot of thought.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? No further questions. So thank you both very much for your great work on this and for bringing it to the board. I know we're all very interested in it. And wish you good luck implementing.
Well, we need a motion, right?
I think it's the voting. I don't know.
Yeah, this is
yes, sorry. I apologize. I forgot this was not just.
I was going to sneak out already.
I'm mixing up information services with informational briefings. So you're absolutely right. We have to vote on this. All right. So with no further questions.
It's not usual that I'm excited about this kind of thing, but I'm happy to make the motion to approve.
Second.
All right. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. That passes. All right. Thank you so much.
Case, members of the board, appreciate the support, and we will see you in a couple of years, I guess, when we come back with something else that we need to talk to you about. Until then, please stay safe and keep healthy. Aloha.
Thank you
so much.
All right, thanks, you too. All right, bye-bye. Okay, board members, we will take a 10-minute break, and we will be back at, let's say, 11:55. Okay, back from break.
Let me get down with this.
One more, Mr. Oi, coming back from break. Waiting for. All right, we are going to move on to now J1.
Good morning, Chairperson Kidd, members, Ed Underwood, Administrator with the Division of Boating and Ocean Recreation. Item J1 is we're coming before you to amend a prior action that occurred on June 12, 2020. This is when we renewed all of our revocable permits. On two of the revocable permits, in the annual rent inadvertently had the monthly rent. So we just wanted to correct that to what the actual annual rent is. And
go ahead.
The two are K. Holy Point Fish LLC and Cordula Corporation.
Thank you. And we have no public testimony on this. So I assume that the applicants are fine with this. They understand it was just a clerical error.
Yes.
Okay. Any questions, board members? If not, is there a motion to approve J1 as submitted?
Or moved.
All right. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor then, say aye.
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 All right, that passes unanimously. Thank you very much. Okay, moving on to J2.
Okay, J2 is an informational briefing. Basically, we're coming back before the board. This pertains to testimony that was submitted by Mr. Silva Rivera regarding item J4 at the Honokaa Small Boat Harbor and GKM, which is one of our tenants. Mr. Rivera alleged some wrongdoing and possible environmental issues. So we looked at all of his allegations and we're reporting back to the board at this time on what we have found. Basically, we look through this. There's a long-standing history with the fueling within the facility. However, we did look at the storage facility. We actually, myself and our assistant administrator, Ms. Megan Statz, went to the facility to visually inspect it. The facility looked clean and in proper order and well-managed. We have no indications that there were ever any fuel spills in that area. They are properly permitted through the Department of Health and they've had their inspections. And also this, as you may or may not know, this fueling facility was initially started with Department of Transportation when they ran the Small Boat Harbor program. And at that time, the fueling was allowed so the tenant could provide fuel for their own tenants, not to the general public. That became an issue that went before the board. It went back and forth between the attorney generals at the time. And as it stands today, it's not really been resolved. We attempted to bring this matter before the board back in November 17, 2017, but that item was withdrawn. We have been working on that and plan on bringing back another submittal so we can clarify the fueling issue in the harbor. There was Mr. Rivera made an allegation that two of our property managers had resigned under duress. and that is not true. Both voluntarily resigned from employment, one of which went to the private sector, and our second property manager actually transferred over to State Parks and is currently working with State Parks. So in conclusion, we could find no wrongdoing regarding fueling, fuel spills, or anything of that nature in the facility.
Thanks for that, Ed. And of course, I suppose if you ask GKM directly whether or not there was any history of spills or other problems, they didn't report any.
That is correct.
And you do have documentation that was forwarded to you from GKM of their, I think it's their current inspection reports. I also want to note that Deputy Masuda has joined us because he was involved in making sure we immediately reviewed this and got back to the board with the report. So he's here also to help answer any questions. All right, any questions, board members? We have no public testimony on this. We do have the material that was provided by GKM.
This isn't an action item, though. It's informational, right?
It's informational, and Bob wants to add something here. Hang on a second.
Awesome.
Bob, you want to unmute?
Yes, Madam Chair, Bob Masuda, First Deputy, DLNR. I just want to provide testimony that indeed, in fact, I followed up with all the property managers and the two former employees of Dobor. Personally and checked and talked with them. There was no alleged, the allegations regarding the issues that, like the fuel tanks and all of that, the poor maintenance, as well as reasons for leaving, were both unsubstantiated and false as far as I could determine. And I reviewed the reports and all of the documentation in the records with the property managers and the administrator and assistant administrator. So I'm pleased to report to the board that I could personally find nothing accurate about the allegations made at the board meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, board members?
Just one, was the letter writer informed about this meeting that we were going to be discussing this?
I did not inform Mr. Silva. I'm not sure. We believe he contacted the board secretary, but we're not sure. We can follow up with him and I can send him our report.
Yeah, I think that the very you should send because there really wasn't a written response, at least when I looked through the our file. We didn't have a written submittal for this, right?
No.
Okay, so they should get something in writing, and then there is still one pending issue. And is there a time frame for bringing bringing that issue of whether fuel sales are allowed under the current lease to the general public? Is there a time frame for bringing that to the board?
We're looking at the first meeting in September.
All right, that's fine. Thank you. You might want to, I don't know what their particular interest is in the matter, but you might want to let them know prior to that that it's coming to the board. So if they have something to say about it, then they have at least have a chance to know what's going on and what's being proposed.
Okay.
Bob, you want to add something?
I just wanted to say to Chris that I could find no connection between the person who made the allegations and the Dovo activities, all the people he was questioning, all the properties on site, I couldn't find any connection in any communication or documents.
He's not like a gas station owner in the vicinity, you know, or not involved with the...
No.
Because we have the fuel dock. And this, I think this is why this became a issue originally, is that there's a few, you know, we have the other lessee there that has the fuel dock, and they pay, you know, some additional amount, which is also at an amount at issue, but they do pay some additional amount for.
If I could find this person's name in connection with any mooring, any boat, any rental or something, I would follow that lead, you know, to determine what the reason was for these kinds of wild allegations, but we couldn't do that.
You know, I think that, you know, as a member of the public, they can inquire, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, well, what is, it, do they have some special interest in the matter? And I think we should still follow through with.
We'll have the staff try to make contact. The difficulty is we couldn't establish a connection, you know, of the person with the issue or why the allegations. There was no other allegations or complaints of the same nature in the same way or similar way.
Okay.
So we will provide a brief response to Mr. Rivera with the results of our review and also let him know when the fuel sales issues is on the agenda.
And one more thing, I was just, you know, Ed, you just said that this was going to be on the board for, I think you said November 17th, 2017. But I'm trying to pull up that meeting now, and I'm not getting a, no, I'm getting a November 9th, 2017.
Was,
can you double check that date?
Yes, that item had been withdrawn, so it may not be show up.
Well, but the date itself doesn't. I don't have a meeting date for November 17th, 2017. I have November 9th, 2017.
Yes, it does say in this November 17th. So I'll have to check it out which the middle that was.
Would you get back
on that date? I took it off of the submittal we had prepared.
Okay.
So I'll have to confirm that date.
Would you email me because and whether or not there was actually a submittal, because sometimes there's a submittal and then it's withdrawn. And then at least I can see what you guys were thinking back in 2017.
I can send you that submittal as well. We do have the submittal.
Okay, that both of those would be useful, I think, in preparation for the next meeting. You know, well, I'll look at it when certainly, you know, when it comes in front of us. You know, we get it a week or so in advance, but I think it'd be useful for me to be able to look at that prior submittal and refresh my memory on these issues because I know it's been kicked around. And I've lost track, frankly, of where we were at with this. I know I personally looked at the issue of the state's compensation on the fuel dock, which is a separate lease, but I don't think I went through the files and looked at this. Although I do think this was, if I'm not mistaken, this was an issue even in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. The question of fuel sales out of at that time Gentry, I think, but you know. An issue raised by, if I'm not mistaken, when the fuel dock either went into bankruptcy or was near in bankruptcy, that they were complaining about this competition from the other lessee.
That is correct. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That's all I have.
That would be really interesting if Mr. Rivera actually comes to the September meeting. Then, Chris, you could question him yourself as to what his involvement is in this matter and what his, you know, what issues he has with it. You know, what's the motivation?
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? And I apologize to Mr. Gomes. I put you back on mute because I get an echo from yours. But if you want to speak, just please unmute yourself. No further questions? Okay, thank you very much, Ed. And that will be done with J2, and we'll look forward to hearing back from you in September.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to move on to K1 now. And Sam, if you have your YouTube on, if you could please turn it off. So K1, we have no testimony on this. Please proceed. Unmute and proceed, yeah.
Yes, there was testimony submitted in support from Waikiki Beach Improvement Association.
Okay, yes. Apologies, I don't have it on my list here. So thank you for that reminder.
Yeah. Thank you. And it might be in the they might be in the Zoom waiting room too. I'm not sure. Thank you, Chair. Sam Lemo, Office of Conservation Coastal Lands. So what we're asking from you today is to grant Chair authorization to sign an MOU with the
And they might be in the they might be in Zoom.
Sorry.
So we're asking you to basically authorize the chair to sign off on an MOU with the Waikiki Beach CETA. To provide $1 million in funding towards a beach maintenance project that we'd like to accomplish as soon as possible, probably this winter. The situation is that, let me just give you a little background. We have a permit from 2012 to basically do beach restoration at Waikiki. We did about 24,000 cubic yards of sand in 2012. Some of you remember that. The permit that we received from you allowed us to come back with a second round of sand restoration, I think between 5 and 10 years. And the number was pegged at 12,000 cubic yards. And so we're here now working the process again to try to do the second round of beach restoration. We have been in extensive talks with the Army Corps of Engineers. I've spoken with the Department of Health, and we're currently in a design process to accomplish this mission. Basically, the situation is that we have a CIP appropriation for FY21 supplemental budget for $2 million. We have $1 million from Waikiki Beach CETA. We have a $2 million CIP appropriation, but that's not quite enough money. So I'm proposing that we also use money from a trust fund that we have. The project was recently estimated to cost around $4 million. The reason it's more money is obviously just inflation and increasing costs of construction. But one of the other reasons is, and as you'll see in the submittal, is that we'd actually like to place 20,000 cubic yards of sand on the beach rather than 12,000 cubic yards of sand, because we have a shot to do this without a lot of people around, unfortunately for our tourism industry, but fortunate for us. And we wanna get the most bang for our buck. And it's not just that we wanna do it, it's really necessary. And it's explained quite extensively in the submittal that you should have as to why we're upping the number to 20,000 from 12,000. The past 5 years, we've seen unprecedented tidal anomalies throughout the Hawaiian Islands. Honolulu tide gauge has been running 6 to 8 inches above predicted NOAA predicted tides. This has been going on for quite a while, and it's really playing havoc with all of our beaches, including Waikiki. So we've lost a lot more sand during the 10-year period than we had originally anticipated. So the bottom line is that the construction or the sand restoration process is no different than what we did in 2012. We're going to the exact same sand source. We're working within the parameters of the same identified sand field. The sand is being placed in the same locations it was in 2012. We're not extending the beach further than it was extended in 2012. We're simply trying to replete this beach with sand out to that 2012 mark. It just so happens that because of circumstances largely beyond our imagination and quite fascinating really, we've lost more sand than we expected because of sea level rise. And so we do want to ask for your consent to basically come in with 20,000 cubic yards of sand rather than 12,000 at this time. It's not really, I don't even see it as much of a project alteration. It's really just trying to basically match the 2012 extent of the sand nourishment. And it'd be a shame if we can't do it because the cost of mobilization and demobilization is quite extraordinary. And to go out and just do 12,000 would be sort of illogical at this point. We have the same request in with the Army Corps and the Department of Health, and hopefully we'll get a positive decision from them soon. Like I said, we're in the design phase. We're working through all of the other necessary permits and approvals. And if everything goes smoothly, we should be in a situation to do the project this winter. So I would like to actually do a couple modifications to the MOU. First, there is a mistake on the first page of the MOU where I think in item C, it talks about the amount of sand that we did in 2012. I think it says 20,000. We actually did 24,000. And I think in the next paragraph, it references 24,000. We want to do 20. So those got switched. The other thing I would like to change in the MOU is the amount. I think we talk about the project costing $2 to $3 million. I need to change those numbers to $3 to $4 million. So those are the amendments I want to make to the MOU. So basically we're asking you for your consent to have Suzanne sign the MOU on your behalf, and then also agree with our little plan change from 12,000 to 20,000 cubic yards of sand. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, board members, questions? Any questions on this?
No question. It seemed like a clear explanation of why you put this forward. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Hearing none. Go ahead.
You know, I don't have any problem with this submittal. I think it's obvious something that we have to do something. And it's it'd be good to get a project underway while there's hardly anybody at Waikiki Beach. How long does it take to actually, how long are like beach activities somewhat disrupted when you do a project like this?
Oh, it's a nightmare, Chris. We just recently finished the Royal Hawaiian Groin, beautiful project. I got the safety signs in. If we had to do that project under normal circumstances, I honestly, it scares me. We pulled off the 2012 project, but there was a major disruption of the beach. We had to basically put a road down Waikiki Beach. We had safety guards and crossing guards to let people walk through the road with their surfboards to get to the water. It was a humongous undertaking. And we avoid so many problems. The project can happen quicker, more efficiently. It's safer for everybody. It's just an all around, and even if tourism comes back online a little bit, it's still not gonna be anywhere near the numbers that we see normally, and I think it will be manageable.
The question, you know, so there's a statement in the submittal that says that increased wave energy should result in more sand on the beach. Am I missing that? Am I getting that wrong here?
I think, you know, Dolan's online here, but I think you're kind of referring to like maybe there's a seasonal fluctuation in the sand volume due to waves and currents, swell direction. And waves can bring sand back into the beaches, but there's a long-term chronic signal for chronic sand loss. And I think that's directly related to heightened tidal anomalies. I'm not really sure what exactly you're reading. I don't have the submittal sitting in front of me right now.
Well, I'm reading the part then in paragraph 5 of the justification that says this 2016 study by Hable et al. Showed that elevated wave energy contributed to increased sand volumes within this beach system. It is more likely that the increased rate of erosion is related to a persistent 6 to 8 inch sea level rise anomaly in the vicinity of Hawaii, which results in more incident wave energy reaching the shoreline. See, I'm trying to reconcile those two statements.
Yeah, and without Shelley present, I'm not sure I can or want to venture there.
Is there that much? Has the sea level, the 6 to 8 inch anomaly, is this something that's popped up in the last few years, or was that true before?
Basically, you know, I've been following this very, very closely, trust me. And I noticed around 2015 some sort of changes that were taking place. You know, we were getting these elevated tides. And then in 2017, as you remember, we had the record tide levels in Honolulu in the summertime. We broke records in May, June, July, August for highest tides ever recorded in Honolulu. Since then, we've had a persistent sort of elevated tide. And while some of that may be due to some decadal type oceanic processes and oscillations, I think the jury's kind of in with respect to, there is some component of permanent sea level rise embedded in this signal, which is really quite alarming, to be honest with you, because we're all kind of talking about how this is something that's sort of maybe deferred off to the future, but no, it's hitting us now. It's going to only increase probably, and we have some serious issues around the state. We're very busy right now.
Well, 6 inches in, say, a decade would be, you know, projected 50 years is catastrophic. So, is a 6 to 8 inch rise, does that show up everywhere in the state or lots of places in the state, or is it pretty much is it a Honolulu thing?
No, it's lots of places. It's not everywhere exactly. And the reason for that is because of these, there are other meteorological anomalies taking place. We have these gyres, mesoscale eddies that are rolling through the islands periodically, and those tend to raise and lower sea level. And so depending on where the gyre is hitting or not hitting, you know, you may have maybe normal tides or higher tides. But I will tell you one thing. I've been watching these tidal gauges for like 5-6 years now, and I don't remember, maybe I have, but I don't remember ever seeing a actual tide go lower than a predicted tide. It always kind of like is right, a few inches above it, or like 6 to 8 or 10 inches above it.
So I wonder if the people who do tide gauges are going to start incorporating
this anomaly, you know, like, yeah, because people rely on the tide gauge. And yeah, rather, like, say you're making a sort of a mental adjustment, probably. If it says a 3.0 high tide, you're thinking, well, that's really going to be a 3.5 high tide.
Sure.
And maybe the people who make the tide gauges are going to have to ground truth the tide gauge, you know, if this is actually something that's happened. Or do they ground truth, or do they change the mean sea level? Do they keep the tides the same, and do they change the datum point of mean sea level?
They don't know what to do because this has never happened before. I'm just kidding. No, actually, Chris, it's a great question. The NOAA, I've been told that they base the tides on these 19-year cycles. Every 19 years, they'll go back and recalibrate the predicted tides so that they can then provide a more accurate prediction for future tides going forward. And so I understand that they're just about at the end of the existing 19-year epoch, and I would assume that they would recalibrate the tides based on what they've seen. Of course, it's probably a very complex modeled process, but no, it's a good question. And yes, they do remodel it to give us a more accurate ground truth predicted tide day in and day out. It's just that it hasn't happened for so long. Things are really out of tune right now. They're really sort of like, you know, the adjustment needs to take place.
Okay, the last thing I have is really a comment, and that is, I don't have any problem with this submittal here, but it looks like this is going to be something that we're going to need maybe time and time again. And I think we ought to look at what is a fair cost sharing between the immediately affected properties and the other funds of the state, because this may come up in, you know, other projects that people want to do. I think, you know, like we have, we talked about one beach nourishment project on Maui for some condos. And I think in that situation, we probably expect them to come up with all the money, right?
Yeah, you know, there's really got to be a strong public purpose behind it. And strong public purpose means, you know, is it a place that really adds to the visitor economy, because the state is dependent on GET and tourism accommodations tax. And so you're going to look at those areas where there's a strong tourism signal. That's not to say that we wouldn't help AOAOs or even smaller, close-knit residential communities, but major funding and management of these projects, unfortunately, is going to have to be the responsibility of the folks that are doing it really for shore protection and not so much visitor economy or tourism or whatever else. Waikiki and Kaanapali are major tourism amenities that, you know, without them, we'd have, we'd have big problems. So we do have a 50-50 cost share at Kaanapali. Waikiki Beach CETA has a taxing district now in place. So they're collecting an assessment from all of the landowners in Waikiki. The numbers that they're able to, the amount of money they're able to contribute to us will depend on how much assessment they can collect. I'm very pleased that they have been participating. They did participate in the Royal Hawaiian groin construction, provided us with like $1 million. And so, you know, it's a work in progress.
What are there? Do you know what the other? I said I was going. I was Powell, but
yeah, you did.
Just one question. Do you know what their total collections are under their improvement district?
I don't know, but if Dolan's available, he might be able to, you know, answer that question.
Dolan, you're here, so
yes. Yeah. I am here. I'm Dolan Eversole. I'm with the University of Hawaii Sea Grant Program. I'm here on behalf of Rick Egged and the Waikiki Beach Special Improvement District. Your question is a very good one, Mr. Ewan, regarding the Beach Improvement District's annual revenues. They vary from year to year. Obviously, it's based on the county's assessed value of each property. But I think it's fair to say this year and in the past couple of years, it's approaching about $1 million a year. And so the Beach Improvement District has been budgeting for the upcoming projects, including the Royal Hawaiian Groin and the Kuhio Sandbag Groin both, and has already budgeted for this beach improvement project. So the money is available and ready to go. And we're already starting to plan for and budget for upcoming beach improvement projects related to the environmental impact statement that's underway with DLNR now.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Okay, Tommy had a question.
I have one too. I got several.
All righty.
Go ahead, Tommy.
Tommy, you're on mute. Jimmy, I'm sorry, but when you have your, can you turn it on mute until you're ready to talk? There's an echo from your side. Thank you.
So Sam, you guys just completed the Royal Hawaiian Groin, yeah?
Yes.
So with this project, determine if the groin worked or not, you know, the design of the groin, because this restoration and sand restoration would go in conjunction with the Royal Hawaiian Groin.
Yeah, I've been out on the beach quite a bit, and you know, the groin is fantastic. It's just it's exactly what we asked for. It's very modest in the layout, and if you go there, you can see already that there's a really nice tombola forming. Like, you know, there's a nice, the sand curves out towards the end of the groin, so that thing is functioning, you know, so far beautifully. I'm really excited if we place additional sand on the beach, you know, just to kind of, you know, just see how the whole thing functions as a unit. But, you know, time will tell. But yeah. So far, it seems to be working great. It doesn't leak.
This is a good, a good test for the, you know, to make sure that the groin design was what is supposed to be there. Yeah. Then if it doesn't work, then wouldn't be needing to come back and restore the beaches too much.
It'll help. But, you know, Tommy, the issue with the sea level is so serious that I think we're always going to have to be actively engaged here. There's nothing that you could really do to, like, design something to prevent the loss of sand due to, like, accelerating sea level rise. We just have to commit to investing in recycling sand there for a few decades. But this will help, you know.
Okay. And then, you know, with your observation of the groin, the adjacent property, you know, the beach change in any way, or, you know, on the opposite side of Royal Hawaiian?
Oh, nothing yet. I haven't really seen anything. I was looking at, there's a little bit of sand in there. I want to see if it accretes sand, because the wave energy, it depends on how the groin affects the wave direction, the wave energy in that corner, and you know, just kind of keeping an eye on it. Too early to tell for that other side.
Yeah, because that's what I was wondering, because, you know, like way down, what is that, by the airport, they build all that groin on the beach, it keeps going until the last groin, and then the beach is gone. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So, you know, I was just hoping that that don't become a problem where we gotta put groins all over to the kind.
Well, you know.
Beach.
Yeah. Well, if you want, you know, I mean, I don't think we're trying to prevent putting any groins at Royal Hawaiian Beach. But, you know, as you all know, we're coming in with, well, you may not know, we're coming in with a environmental impact statement to look at some longer term improvements to Waikiki Beach, which does not include any groins at Royal Hawaiian Beach, but will include a little groin field in front of Sheraton and Halekulani, because there's no beach there. So the question really becomes, do you want a beach there or not? If you want a beach there, you'll have to put in some sort of retention structure.
I see.
Yeah.
That's understandable.
Yeah, but we're trying to, once again, you know, I mean, I would take a look at that Royal Hawaiian groin and, you know, just to kind of see how it affects you.
Okay. We can't get there.
Well, what, you know.
All right, Sam. Thanks.
Okay, Mr. Gomes.
Okay. First of all, this is to staff. As far as I'm going off of Keone Downing's, our past board member, and one of the questions he had that the public did not receive adequate time allotted to review, because he was told that once they post the agenda item, getting the information was up to the public. So, you know, I thought that's not true. So I need an answer to that, because he feels that, you know, because they didn't have enough time for the public to review this particular K1 item.
So I can speak to that. We did miss being able to post the item itself until yesterday morning. And thank you to Mr. Downing for pointing that out to us. But it was listed as the agenda item. So that provides public notice of the discussion.
But and it was added. Yeah, but that was added. But okay, yesterday morning. But what his point is that the public didn't have enough time to read it, or they have to go get their information on their own. I don't think that's correct, is it?
It is much preferred to get the agenda submittals themselves up at the same time as the agenda. But the main point for Sunshine purposes is adequate public notice of the discussion.
Yeah. So here's the other question that I have also. And Sam had alluded to that the way the climate change is been changing so rapidly over on our shorelines and throughout the state of Hawaii. By going ahead with this project, and we're gonna go on the basis of a 2012 EIS, shouldn't a new EIS be made? You know, and if we're going on the old EIS and they have to take from areas of A and B, and we've had issues where they went down below the substrate and what the sand came out is like a golf ball size, you know, and are we going to have that? Is there the same levels of sand in those areas of A and B, Sam?
Yeah, the coral rubble issue is specifically going to be addressed in the scope of the construction. They're going to have to screen better to make sure that we don't get those coral rubble chunks. So that's going to be part of that'll be part of their RFP. We're going to put an RFP out on that so that we can find the best value. And that'll be one of the criteria, you know, how well somebody can demonstrate they can accomplish doing that. This was done in 2012, and the EA and the permitting all anticipated a second round of maintenance. And so we wouldn't really have to go back and do another document.
But being that you have climate rise that is affecting it so quickly, wouldn't you think that there would be a change after 8 years, a drastic change of what we have now presently compared to what it was back in 2012?
Well, the only change, frankly, is that we need to put more sand on the beach, you know?
So where did the sand go?
Probably went back onto the offshore sand deposits where we got it.
So, you know, there were, I know that what you just said earlier, that the project to do this took so much coordination because of separate roads and how you dealt with the public and XYZ, et cetera, et cetera. Is there other methods of transporting the sand? You know, any new ways to transport sand rather than what we've done in the past, you know?
Yeah, you know, there are different methods. You can go in with we're doing hydraulic suction dredge and direct pumping. You could do a clamshell system with a clamshell bucket. You know, just send the clamshell down and.
Yeah, we did it at Tihe Boat Ramp, and we did it at the Lahaina Front Street, the harbor, with the vacuum.
Yeah. We're not ruling out a different approach, but, you know, I would like to keep it, you know, as close as we can to what was done in 2012, just to, you know, make sure that we're not getting off the rails on, you know, what was authorized, but, it's certainly something that if somebody came up with a wonderful idea for doing it differently, we'd certainly like to hear what they have to say. We've looked at a lot of different
things. Yeah, so when the study was done, and for you to go in round 8, you know, again, I'm just taking off of Keone. Why wasn't a study made of where was the sand going? Because since we lost it all.
Well, we didn't lose it all. I mean, we lost.
You're putting 20,000 rather than 12,000.
Yeah. I mean, the sand goes from east to west, obviously, during 90% of the time. And in the past, it was hitting that old groin and going out to a sandbar, and then it probably gets deposited further offshore in the old sand fields that we are currently retrieving the sand from. So we know where the sand, I mean, we did beach profiling for years, and beach profiling is ongoing by University of Hawaii, and they can tell us where the sand is going on the beach and in the nearshore area. It's hard to trace the sand just because I don't think anybody has really the LIDAR capability to really understand that clearly. But anecdotally, if you just look at this situation, and I think probably Keone would agree, sort of kind of heads east to west, bounces off into the bar, some comes back, some gets to the near shore. There's probably a lot of it gets dumped in offshore sand fields, 2,000 feet offshore.
Okay, so Sam, being that you got your extraction of sand would be in the recovery areas of A and B, yeah. Do you know if they're at the same heights as they were at 2012 when you did the extraction?
I haven't reviewed I know that the consultants have already gone out and probed the sand field. I don't have that information right in front of me. But anecdotally, it appears that these sand, you know, because you don't dig all the sand in these sand fields, like sand from an area. But the holes that you create do tend to fill in pretty quickly. Whether that's from sand, existing offshore sand field, or sand coming, probably a combination of both cause the sand field sort of replenish itself, but I don't have a number on the current elevation of the sand field in the offshore sand port, although that information is out there.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Those are good questions. Are there other questions, comments? Okay, hearing none. Do I have a motion to approve K1 as submitted?
Also move.
Okay, is there a second?
Seconded.
All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right, any opposed?
I oppose.
Okay.
No.
Mr. Gomes opposes. Otherwise, the 6 votes are in favor are gone. Case Char, Yuen, Yoon, and Oi. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Yep. Thank you, Dawn.
Okay. Our last items are M, 6, 7, and 8. Mr. Gomes, do you mind if I put you back on mute? Thank you. Okay, are you ready?
Might be having connectivity problems.
Yeah, I think we're still connecting here. Yeah, you know, Mr. Matsumoto, you might want to turn off your video because you're a little slow connectivity, so it might help if you turned your video off.
Okay.
Because we can hear you, but the visual is a little, now it's harder to hear you. Nope. Right, I'm going to turn your video off. There you go. Let's see if that works.
Okay, thank you. I can't, mine's off from here.
Yeah, okay. I think let's try just with audio. Okay, go ahead. M6 and 7.
Okay, my name is Scott Matsumoto. I'm with the State Department of Transportation. I'm here for the dedication of land to the Department of Transportation Highways Division for highway purposes relating to Haleakala Road. We were approached from the consultant and they want to convey a portion of the road that they built to the Department of Transportation for highway purposes.
Sorry, consultant for the landowner.
I don't remember who approached me initially. From Pacific Rim Land, Leilani.
Oh, oh right.
Pumamo, right, okay. From Pacific Rim Land.
She is here available, so let me just make sure she's here. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, got it. Okay. Anything else to add? Or Ms. Pumano, did you want to add anything? And if so, you're on mute. There you go.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Leilani Pumano and I'm with Pacific Rim Land. So this dedication of the highway is for a highway road widening that crosses Old Haleakala Highway and Haleakala Highway on the island of Maui. We did a residential subdivision and as part of the residential subdivision, during our construction plans, the state DOT requested for a dedicated right out lane to Haleakala Highway from Old Haleakala Highway. So this is the the a road widening lot that was part of our piece of property that we have are dedicating to the high, to the state DOT in order to comply with our construction plans for the Kualono residential subdivision. And I just want to say that the subdivision is constructed and it's sold out, and the roadway improvements have been completed to state DOT standards.
Thank you. Could you just, I guess we don't have a map of where this is exactly on Maui. Could you just give us a
sure
a brief orientation there?
Do you mind if I share my screen and I can show you okay, the dedication yeah. map?
That'd be great.
Okay, great. Please let me know when you see the screen.
Yeah, we see that screen.
Okay, hopefully you can. So this is
okay. So it's Pukalani Bypass, I guess.
Correct.
Okay.
And this is the Kualono subdivision here, and we're just talking about this one small area here.
Okay, so it's right at or near Pukalani.
Correct.
Okay.
The corner of where the old highway meets and the new highway meets. It's a very small sliver, about 1,700 square feet.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, questions, board members? All right, Mr. Gomes, do you have any questions?
No, I move to approve if there's no, right. no other questions. Second.
All right, all in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you very much. That passes. Thank you, Ms. Pomano.
Thank you very much.
Matsumoto, I guess you can do M7.
I'm not involved with the M7.
Okay.
That would be our acquisition portion. I'm with property management. So I'm not sure what that project is.
Bye. Bye.
Sorry.
All right. I think Ms. Sawai, if you have YouTube open, can you turn it off, please?
Yes, I will.
Okay. All right. I think we have nobody here for DOT for number 7. Okay. Board members, do you have any questions about number 7? Tommy, you're on mute.
What happened is that they were going to redo the pedestrian bike overpass in LALA. So I think they're in the design stages now. But what happened is a vehicle knocked the whole thing down. So, and that was the safest route for the kids to go to the get across the street. So I think it's very urgent to, you know, have it done right away.
Okay, thank you. There's no testimony on this. Do you want to make a motion to approve D7?
Move to approve.
Second.
Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, that passes unanimously. Thank you. Okay, Ms. Soai, D8. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. My name is Bridget Soai, and I'm the DAG's leasing branch manager. And today, what I'm doing is, well, requesting is seeking your approval for the consent to the issuance of a revocable permit. This is for a media space located at the state capitol in the basement chamber chamber area or chamber level.
Thank you. Okay, anyone have any questions about this? Okay, hearing none, is there a motion to approve?
We'll move.
Second.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It passes. All right, thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of our agenda. Board members, thank you for all of your service today, and thank you to the public for listening in. All right,
have a great weekend, everyone.
Bye.
Be safe, people in Hawaii.